kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to Today in Digital Education, Tide, episode 102, with me, Doug Belshaw.
And me, Di Barnes. Hello, mate. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. So one of my neighbours is hammering away out the back, so if you hear some kind of knocking noise, that's what he's doing. Frank, my lovely neighbour. But yeah, it's been, it been 3 weeks since we last spoke?
Two, I think.
Two, okay. Well, yeah, a lot seems to have happened in those 2 weeks.
It's life, isn't it? It's like a roller coaster.
What have you been up to?
I've been giving out service pros to teachers plenty. I've been getting children ready for exams. So crazy amounts of marking. I've done a quick cycle of reporting. What else have I done? I played town versus gown squash. So I played the local squash club, the teachers of the school. And where I was really bad, which was a real disappointment. And other than that, just work, just teaching and getting on with it, really. But so one of the things we've done, so we've decided to do this thing with email, which is quite an interesting tactic. I don't know, change of tack, which is to not stop people using centrally created distribution lists. So like a distribution list for a year group or to all teachers, for example.
All right, so not ones that like, you've created to all the people who are coming to your after school class or whatever. So the ones which the school uses from like its MIS.
That's right. So through the Active Directory thing it is. So the idea being is that everyone who sends an email has to reflect upon or think a little bit more about who they're sending it to so that people who don't need to see it don't get it. Also to sort of improve the use of our sort of formal channels for broadcasting information rather than just sending it to everybody's inboxes all of the time. So I've not really had a problem with my inbox, but this was a request from a leadership team when they wanted to do this. So we're giving it a go and it's got my name on it and I'm having to face a lot of people kind of rolling their eyes and getting a bit annoyed and worried about their work load. Quite interesting. So we're going to see how that goes. So we're going to put it in place and do it for 4 weeks after half term and then review it before the end of the year and see if we do it in September or not.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think organizational communication, I think Moodle, every organization I've been in has struggled to some extent with organizational communication because it's easy to point to the tool as being the problem. But email's been around for what, 35, 40 years? And so like, we should be used to using it by now, but nobody teaches you how to use it. And it's very simple to use, but it's also quite complex to use well. And I've learned some things along the way. I wouldn't say that I'm amazing, but I'm certainly better than some people I email with. And I think people point to the tool and say, look, we need to do something about this tool because the tool is the problem. But the tool isn't the problem. The way that people use the tool is the problem.
No, email is awesome. I mean, it really is. I mean, it's one of those very successful digital tools, I think. People are so very comfortable with it. They understand its passage in the main, its passage through your life and how to make it work. I do worry sometimes that people live in their inboxes a little bit too much rather than getting on with deeper work. But yeah, and I think it's kind of good. And people pass the buck via email as well. But so I would like to, but what was it? A good friend of mine once, who I won't name, said that a senior colleague at his school, somebody on the same level as him, refused to deal with an email until he topped and tailed the email appropriately, which I thought was hilarious.
What does that mean?
Dear whatever, yours sincerely or whatever, you know, top and tail. Kind of thing. So it's quite interesting how that works. And I'm quite informal in mine. So I'll use dear in the first instance. I always sign them off yours, et cetera. But I always try and put the key information at the top of the email. So what I wanted to do was to sort of improve, help people write better emails. So you put like the most important information at the top of the email, and then you put your rationale or your wordage for whatever underneath it, and people can read it if they have time at the point where they where that email hits them. So we're trying this, and we'll see what happens. And I've invited teachers to get into the idea of planning an email policy, and we could tweet some other things later down the line. We'll see.
Well, I think just before we hit record, we were talking a little bit about this, and one of the things I didn't mention there was the fact that documentation is the wider issue. You know, if you're drawing concentric circles around the problem, which might start with I'm getting too many emails or whatever, there's a concentric circle you get to, which is documentation. And I was talking to, I'm going to talk later on about the technical architect interviews I've been doing with people for the MoodleNet position. Uh-huh. But I was talking to one person this day, and he was like, oh yeah, you can have a look at my code, but it's not very well commented or documented, which in open source projects is a real problem, obviously, because you're trying to get contributors in. And if you kind of compare any organization with an open source project, what you're trying to do is to make the organization or the project legible in a way that anyone can understand it. And of course, if everything is kind of held within an email thread or within a distribution list or whatever, it makes it very difficult for someone who comes along new, like a new teacher in September, or somebody who hadn't been copied in or whatever. Email does make it very difficult in that regard. So I think that email's great, as you say, but should only be part of a wider system, if you see what I mean.
No, I think that's right, and that's what's going on. So we're looking to encourage more face-to-face communication, and as well as use of information bulletins or whatever that go out every day or every week, and try that. So it's about just sort of bringing some focus and attention to how it is we communicate with each other. But I don't necessarily think it's. I'm not sure it's the first shot I would have taken. You're doing the distribution lists at tackling this issue, but it is the one we've taken. So it's I've been dealing with a lot of full of feedback, shall we say, or concerns to do with that people are having. Mm. Some people use them avidly. You know.
Okay. A couple of things actually on that, which I've just seen in the last few days. One, just before we came on this call, actually, so I haven't read it. The first one is that people might be thinking about email, especially in the light of privacy and security. And I've certainly tried to set up things like PGP and GPG, which is pretty good privacy. It's email encryption. I don't know if you've ever tried to use it, Di, and had like a public key.
No, I don't.
But it's a pain in the arse to set up properly. And actually, the Electronic Frontier Foundation have reported that there's a serious flaw in PGP. And if you use PGP with HTML, then there's a huge risk of getting hacked. There's actually a flaw in Signal as well. So that's the first thing. And the second thing, which I haven't read yet, is Mozilla today have launched with the Open Tech Strategies organization something called Open Source Archetypes, a framework for purposeful open source. So you might think, if you're an educator, if you're not like an open source organization, you might think, well, how is this relevant to me? But it's like a 39-page document that you can download for free. There's a GitHub repository for it as well. And it talks about ways in which you can structure your organization to get more communication, input, participation, whatever. So I've just really quickly skimmed it before we started talking. But because I know Mozilla reasonably well, I think it's exactly the kind of thing which is going to be useful to loads of organizations to think, well, what type of thing are we trying to do here? What archetype are we? And kind of structure their communications and information sharing appropriately. Because for me, if you're in an organization that's using loads of email, then you use Slack. I'd consider something like that. I'd consider something like WhatsApp or Telegram for the senior management team. Like, think about all the different elements to it. Think about like how, if you need to see that it's been read, how quick does it need to show up? Like how secure does it need to be? Because email is not a secure thing. I was talking to my son about this the other day, about just being like sending a postcard. And I guess it's a bit more secure when you're sending it internally on your own mail server. But even so,
it's a fair thing. But that's not what we're dealing with. We're dealing with users at the moment. So
Of course. And you've been interviewed as well.
I was. It was an interview that was palmed off to me, really. Let me go and find the notes on it. Hang on a second.
So what is Schoolhouse Magazine?
I have no idea. Sorry, it's just a magazine that talks about schools, and our marketing department asked me if I'd do the interview. It was palmed off from the head to the deputy head to me, but it was to do with digital learning. So I just kind of critiqued it, saying I can find the document that I wrote if I search for it.
Is it going to be published online, or is it one of those kind of offline only things?
I'm not sure yet. I just I was asked. So I wrote, but I thought I wrote some fairly interesting answers. So it was, what is your school's overall approach to digital learning? So I said, learning in a school may be digitally enhanced, but it is never exclusively digital. You cannot isolate a learning event or episode as digital because it comprises many variables that are at play before and during the process. That said, at Aundel, we embrace digital opportunities that improve our learning, and we are cautious to protect the processes that have been the bedrock of our academic success. The quality and experience of our teachers enables them to judge which technology adds value to learning and when it should be used. The best examples of this extend to our pupils making these decisions for themselves. And then the other questions it asks are, what sorts of tools do you use and what makes them special? How do you think digital learning has changed teaching? Does your school provide equipment, or does it require pupils to bring them with them mandated equipment? And is it Mac or Windows? Do you use Inkable devices?
What Mac or Windows, if they're the two options.
And well, they are. Well, there's more, but obviously they are the main ones. Everyone will run a network of those too, except if you've gone to Chromebooks, I think. What do you think the particular advantages of such devices are as teaching aids? That's Inkable devices like Surfaces and iPad Pros, I guess. And to what extent do you interact with other schools about such matters? And what do you teach? What's your job title? And how do you interact with your colleagues and assess their needs and responses to digital learning? So that will be in Schoolhouse Magazine. Should you never buy a copy, I'm sure. That would be okay.
Cool. Okay. Well, given that you hadn't heard of it before you did the interview with them, that's interesting.
Yes. I mean, I wouldn't do because I've never used it to...
I tell you what, I thought that first answer was great. And interestingly, I've been interviewing people in preparation for the MoodleNet design sprint, which I'll talk about in a moment. But it's interesting to find... I guess I'm in a bit of a bubble, I guess, with my kind of working for a company that makes a learning management system and all that kind of stuff, and knowing people who work remotely and teach online and stuff. But people who I knew who did blended learning, I worked at an institution but also taught online, and it was a blended thing. Almost all of them seem to be moving exclusively online for cost saving at the moment.
Yes. Okay. So who's moving online exactly?
Those people I was talking to, like Greg McVerry, his courses are going to be going from being blended to being online. I've been doing interviews project. And especially a lot of the like older guys I've been speaking to, he's like, oh, well, you know, I've been doing this blended learning course. It's been part face-to-face and part online, and that's going to be fully online from next year. And like, it must have been, it's a small sample size, but you know, fully 75% of the people I'm talking to who teach in universities are like going to be teaching fully online from next year.
Oh, okay. Well, that's quite interesting. So I put at the end of this, I consider it my job to promote and manage the development of digitally enhanced teaching and learning whilst preventing the shorter-lived, widely hyped technological initiatives from diluting the quality of an Aundel education. So, and that's kind of...
Hmm.
Being discerning.
You've talked about being in a bit of an Aundel bubble before, etc., which is a very nice bubble to be in. I'm in a bit of a remote bubble and all that kind of stuff. But there have been predictions about two levels to education where...
Three.
You know, the cheap option is doing things online, not physically co-present, and the more expensive one, much more expensive one, the elite version, is, you know, face-to-face with an enthusiastic teacher.
Yeah, teacher in the room, and then you have the middle tier, which is a blend of the two, which is blended learning, one might argue. It's kind of interesting, I guess. But we'll see where that goes. But I mean, it is inevitable that things are going to go online because of the cost-saving facility that is in the long term. Mm-hmm. But also, as people learn to learn online, as they get familiar with it, they will want more of that, you know, more of learning at your own pace, working at your own pace, and you develop a narrower skill set, but possibly a more refined one, I think.
Mm-hmm. There was a really interesting, I'm not going to find it quickly enough to put it in the show notes, but Seth Godin's got a podcast called Akimbo, if you've listened to that.
No.
And in this Akimbo podcast, he was talking about things being efficient versus being unique or something like that. And someone had, at the end of each podcast, he answers questions from listeners about previous podcast episodes. And he was, someone had asked him a question about, in what situation is it right to do things live versus being efficient, or can live be efficient or whatever? And he was talking about using Facebook Live and that kind of thing, and how you can do things differently. But he was saying you'd never want to like propose marriage via video, via pre-recorded video. You want to do things live. Some things are better live. But I think sometimes you can learn things very efficiently by doing things I'm thinking things like Duolingo and Khan Academy, the things we've talked about before, where it's spaced learning, it's motivational, it's gamified, all that kind of stuff. And I feel like there's some things like that which you could learn really well, as opposed to, and I'm showing a bias here as an ex-history teacher, things like history, where it doesn't really work like that. Like, you need the enthusiastic teacher. Computer science is a bit like that as well. I guess there's elements of computer science that you could learn through what I was been talking about before. But there's elements of computer science where you just need someone who's really passionate about the subject to show you what's going on. So I'm wondering whether the middle tier ends up being a bit like my daughter going to piano lessons. She could just do piano by herself by watching YouTube videos, the Apple Music thing, whatever. But the reason she goes to Dave, who's a composer in his own right and a musician, is because he's really cool, she thinks, and he enthuses her so that she wants to go and practice all week. Like, that's the interesting blended learning space for me.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. So the intrinsic motivation that comes from working with somebody is really, really important. And you can't underestimate it. And that's whenever people talk about solely online learning, to me, I always kind of start thinking it's getting a bit Star Trek, where they train all their super scientists to be super scientists. But the problem is that you don't, I always think the most interesting television series to be made is what's going on to all the people who don't make it into up in the spaceships in Star Trek,
right, like, exactly.
Or back down on Earth. What's life like for them, you know? I think that's the thing that you will lose, is you will lose that sense of motivation. But I don't think, see, when people are talking about these three different tiers of education, they're not really talking about the education systems that you and I are familiar with in the UK. They're talking about global systems, different countries around the world, different cultures, where the approach to education is very different because their socioeconomic situations are very different, as well as their climates, et cetera.
And they're trying to do things at scale as well.
Absolutely.
And that, as we talked about before, caring doesn't scale and scaling doesn't care.
Indeed. That's absolutely right. So, It's a bit like trying to climb a mountain. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, nice segue there. Thank you. So, not last weekend, but the weekend before, it was bank holiday weekend in the UK. And as we've talked about before, I think, I travel quite a bit, so coming back and then saying to my family, hey, I'm going to go and climb a mountain for 2 days now, is increasingly difficult. So we decided to pack my kids off to their grandparents, my parents, which they enjoyed. And my wife, Hannah, said that she wanted to come up a mountain. So I was very encouraging about that. I was slightly concerned because she had hurt her knee. She can't run at the moment, even though she's supposed to be preparing for the Great North Run. And so I was a bit concerned about how she was going to cope with that, but she coped really well. And I've written up I'm doing these days, as I have to do 20 quality mountain days, as they're known. So only in certain mountainous parts of the UK and Ireland. And it has to be a more than 5 hours above a certain height. And it has to have some element of challenge. So I can't just stay on the paths, etc. So I won't go into details, but I've written up those 2 days in terms of planning, what we did, how I managed to be a bit lazy with my planning. And the first day was a bit of I had to come down a precipice with Hannah, which she was not happy about at the end. And it did make me reflect on leading other people and who are less experienced and that kind of thing. A wonderful experience. And it was glorious sunshine for quite a lot of it. So very much enjoyed that. That was up in the Galloway Hills. And I live in the northeast of England, as you know, but actually the Galloway Hills, because of the Scottish border, are almost exactly horizontally west of me.
Oh, okay. Right. I didn't realize the border was that wiggly.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm actually, when you used to live up here as well, you were living further north than some parts of Scotland.
All right. I never knew that. I did know, you get a sense of Scotland before you get to Scotland, in the north of England. You know what I mean? It kind of approaches you.
Because the border goes almost, not 45 degrees, but it's a bit shallower than that. But it's,
From east to west, yeah.
So very much enjoyed that. And then the rest of my time over the last couple of weeks has been spent on really preparing for this MoodleNet design sprint that we're doing in London next week. And I knew that you wouldn't be able to get out of your duties on a Thursday, which is why I didn't even bother asking you. But on the Thursday the 24th, we're going to get some people in to do some user testing because we're going to be doing some kind of wireframes of MoodleNet. MoodleNet being, for those things, for those people who aren't aware, a new kind of social media platform for educators focused on professional development and open content. That's the project I'm leading at Moodle. And so as part of that, I've been interviewing lots of people about a technical architect position. So I think almost 70 people have applied, and I must have spoken to about between 10 and 15, I would say. And there's one person who really stands out. So hopefully they'll be coming on board sometime soon if they can negotiate all the things that stand in the way, the usual things. There's a MoodleNet survey out, which will be closing probably Friday night. So we're recording this on Tuesday the 15th. So this will probably close on, what will that be, the 18th. You can win. There's two Amazon e-vouchers to be won, or credit for the Moodle online store. And what we're trying to find out with the MoodleNet survey are people's habits and practices when they're looking for resources, planning lessons, what state of mind they're in, what tools they use, that kind of thing, to kind of provide the data for the design sprint. Last time I looked, there were about 120 responses to that, which is great. Some interesting trends coming out.
Cool.
I've also been interviewing people just like on Zoom, recording some video with people asking similar kinds of questions about how they find and curate and share resources, how they connect with other educators online and how they develop professionally, and recording those in preparation for the sprint as well. So that's been an interesting process. What else have I done?
Your monitors.
So I was using, I had great plans for my old kind of 1080p full HD monitor. Now I've got this 4K monitor. But those plans weren't going to materialize anytime soon. I remembered that actually it rotates to 90 degrees, so you can have a portrait. And so my little Chromebox that I've got can actually power two monitors. And what had happened was I was having some flickering issues with my new monitor. And I thought I had a problem with the monitor. And I long story short, I read an email newsletter from someone who I follow. And they said that it had taken them all morning to realize that it was their cables they had a problem with. And sure enough, I changed both cables on the monitors and I had no problems at all. So I've now got my 4K monitor in landscape and my full HD monitor in portrait, which is pretty awesome.
Oh, we're looking at, it's interesting, we're relocating our department over the summer to a temporary place. And one of the things in the dual screens I was thinking of doing, because the setup is different in these classrooms, which are just tables, they're not professionally benched, if you know what I mean, is to put one monitor on a PC laying down on the table and then put the other one portrait next to it in the double monitor thing. And I actually thought, for what we do, like for programming, etc., the greater height of the monitor is more important. A sort of thing, and I think people just become accustomed to having that extra width, but the height can be really useful if you have another leaf, like, so the same setup you've got there.
So I mean, for example, right now I've got our show notes as a Google Doc on the portrait monitor, and it really does make a difference. Like, you start realizing that there's you become freed from the tyranny of the landscape screen, shall we say. It's great.
Yes, it's much easier to keep things focused, isn't it?
Spoiled by a 4K monitor as well, though. So even full HD looks a bit, but hey.
Yeah, no, I think it's I do think there's lots of dead space on web browsers these days. You know, there's lots of white space. People are getting more screen estate, but it just fills up with blank space at the sides of your whatever, generally speaking.
While we're talking about wasted space, apologies if you're one of these people, Di, but I never understand why, when people have got widescreen monitors, they have like all the little icons along the bottom of their screen. Why would you waste more space, like vertically, when you could put them over to the side? I don't get it.
Well, I think it's about habit, isn't it? So so you just said that, and I do have that. So I don't have this issue because my monitor is enormous. So
just remind people how big it is.
It's 43 inches.
Not the size, it's what you do with it.
Apparently so. But if you know, if what you do with it's good and the size is good, then it's
well happened. Indeed.
So, but I have mine along the bottom, but I just think that's to do with familiarity.
And well, when you've got 43 inches of screen real estate, I don't think that's an issue. But when I see people on there, like, so, Hannah's got a new MacBook. You know, did I tell you about the ongoing saga of Dell? Did we get to that?
You did. You got the money. You got the money for laptops. So, it's great news.
I bought, Hannah was dithering. I bought her a MacBook, the 12-inch one. So obviously, like my Lenovo X220, you know, Ubuntu by default puts the thing down the side because it knows that most people have widescreen monitors. If you haven't done this before, everybody listening, if you've never put your dock, as it's known, on Mac or Windows or Linux usually has it down the side, there's an option. Right click on it and just put it down the side, or even just hide it off the side of the screen or whatever. It makes such a big difference, that little bit of, you know, screen real estate.
I think it does, because it is, because on the widescreen monitors, which have become the default of the 16:9 proportions, it is the depth that you lose, as we were just saying. You know, you don't lose the width at all, you get more width, which is actually unused, but the depth is never unused because of scrolling. So it's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. What else? It's Sats week this week for Key Stage 2 kids. So Ben, my son, 11-year-old son, has got those at the moment. Had to take him to hospital last night because he had badly hurt his shoulder, had to have an x-ray, but no bone damage, thankfully. But that hasn't helped in terms of the whole preparation and stuff. His school, Newminster, got notice to improve from Ofsted.
All right, okay. How's Chantry? Is that all right?
No. That's the head's been replaced. So.
Oh, gosh.
I think they got unsatisfactory. So, yeah, all things change. And, you know, living in a market town where people move there a lot of the time because of the school's reputation, it affects house prices as well eventually. So we'll see.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when are Ben's Sats? Are they today or tomorrow?
So he had Monday. So it's Tuesday today. He's had Monday, Tuesday. He's got Wednesday, Thursday, and then he's finished. And they have like a chill out week next week before half term. So.
Oh, well, do wish him my best.
Yes, I will do. It's interesting, though, and I'd be interested to hear from other people if other schools and places do this. There's obviously a lot of pressure these days on schools to get decent results because of what I've just been saying, and that's the main thing that their results are looked at by Ofsted and league tables and all this kind of stuff. Uh-huh. And it's great that, you know, he can go to school every morning this week and get a free breakfast. But it's funny that it coincides with exam week, you know.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I think that's a fair shout.
Well, while we're talking about shout outs, I do want to. We gave a shout out to another podcast in a previous week, London CLC. So, Sarah Horrocks, hi, Sarah, if you're listening. They have started a new podcast after Brian Mathers and I kind of encouraged them to do so. So, I've yet to listen to it, but I'll put the link in the show notes. Very much looking forward to hearing Sarah and Julia and I think Christian. Talking about pedagogy and technology and education, that kind of thing. Anyway, so let's crack on with, that's been a long introduction, let's crack on with some of the links that we've got in here. Let's go with yours first because it looked more interesting. So do you want to introduce the first one?
So this article is by Dominic Norrish, who is who's pictured in the article sitting in a server room or more like a data center, to be honest. And he is, what is he? The head of digital strategy for United Learning, I think, which is an organization of academies, various primary, secondary, and independent schools, prep schools, and turnover about 400 million a year. As you can see from, if you look at the picture, you'll see what their data center looks like. Anyway, so this is really interesting because he's talking about the move to the cloud, and it's obviously something that you and I don't think would question, and lots of people are doing. But it's something that I'm actually doing by handing out the Surface Pros that I'm doing to teachers. Part of the training that they're getting is that transition to the cloud. So they're no longer on the surfaces. They're not domain registered machines. So they don't have access to their My Documents on our network or the shared areas on our network. Mm. And they have to start migrating things to the cloud and trying. They have Google. They have Citrix Remote Desktop, which is a really a cloud storage solution. That gives them an access to a Windows 7 computer that they can use and be in their comfort zone, if you like, be in their familiar tool set. And they also have the Google Suite and Microsoft OneDrive. And they can choose anyone they like and have a go with it and see how it works. So Dominic talks about collaboration, information security, resilience, risk reduction, mobility of access, advantages. So that it's cheaper. So he talks about desktop applications.
Does he talk about disadvantages?
Server costs. No, I don't think he does. Oh, Gideon Williams left a note on this post. A good friend of mine.
I feel like this could have been written 10 years ago, or like.
Well, no, that's what I thought about it, but I thought it was worth, because I'm dealing with this at the moment, it was worth me sticking out on Twitter, and a few people might read it accordingly, sort of thing. But I think it is good.
Right, so let's just go through them. It's better. Well, that's subjective. Let's just start with that. Collaboration. Yes, it is easier, but let's just zoom out to the wider thing. Why would you move to the cloud? The cloud is putting your data on someone else's computer instead of the ones which are owned by your institution. Why would you do that? Well, because economies of scale, because you can more easily get access wherever you are in the world. Et cetera, et cetera. And also the people who look after the infrastructure for those kinds of things that are happening at scale will probably have better DevOps people. So developer operations, you know, better in terms of security, that kind of thing.
Of course they will. Let's say you say,
but any post that only talks about the benefits of the cloud without talking about, surveillance, about kind of different risk surface when it comes to security, in terms of privacy and data mining of students. Like, I feel like that.
I feel that is always about cloud. The cloud is more secure. Google and Microsoft are more secure than we can ever make it. But the point being is that we are just a school in the middle of nowhere, whereas they are global corporations who are being attacked on a daily basis many times. And and they will have to do their resilience to that. And obviously, but if someone does get through and something does go wrong, then our stuff is vulnerable. And that's an important thing to realize.
Well, security is always a relevant thing, isn't it? Like if I'm sending you notes, which I've written on a piece of paper through the mail, that's a really bad metaphor, but you know what I mean? Like there's different, you have to think about what your threat model is and stuff. So yeah. And to be fair, this is written for like techie educators as opposed to like professional technologists. But like anytime people only give you one side of the argument, take it with a pinch of salt.
I think that's true. So all the points he makes are valid, but there are points that you can critique, and it would be nice to see a more balance in this.
Yeah.
I think, without doubt.
Also only pointing to, like, you can self-host in the cloud, and that's not an option in here. He's just talking about Microsoft and Google.
Yes, no, that's the other thing that I would have thought as well. But clearly, if you look at his that server room that he's sitting in, that's not the case.
Mm-hmm. So for example, I'm only going to use this because I work for the organization and it's the first thing that pops into mind. But like you can self-host your Moodle site or you can run it in the cloud. Yeah, Moodle cloud. It's the same thing, pretty much. You just decide to put it on someone else's infrastructure. But he's suggesting that the two things are like chalk and cheese. They're not. They're like chalk and cheese if you decide to buy into the products and services and hardware that are provided by cloud service providers. But the fundamental thing is, where are you going to put your data and why do you want to store it in that place rather than somewhere else? And I think there's a much wider issue here of schools not paying IT people enough. Therefore, in general, and I'm talking broad brushstrokes, because in any sector, if you don't pay as much as they could get elsewhere, you are not going to get the best people who are doing that kind of work. Mm-hmm. So there's so many layers of stuff and things to unpack here that I think I need to read in depth, but it just seems a bit rah-rah, go with Microsoft and Google because I have, and therefore I'm right.
Yeah, and I also think there's it's an interesting point to that you kind of want the data on your site as well. I mean, you want to be in the cloud, but you want to have that data mirrored so that you are protected in that way.
Yeah, so going back to the email thing, if you run your own email server and you're emailing each other internally, that email is not going anywhere outside your network. If are using Google Apps and that kind of thing, unless they're doing some jiggery-pokery that I haven't seen recently, all of that data is being sucked up by Google. And okay, they're providing services like, you know, suggesting that, oh, do you want to include this extra person, or you haven't added that attachment, or doing all that kind of stuff. But they are siphoning up all of your data as well, which you may or may not want.
I think that's true, but I think there's an important thing to note in that. What am I trying? I just caught a mosquito, sorry. An important thing to note is that, what am I trying to say? Yeah, so what often tends to happen, and schools tend to do, and certainly schools I've worked in, which is my fault, I guess, considering my job title, is that you end up bringing in these cloud services, but you don't migrate away from the existing network services that you employ, so your Windows network or whatever. Yes, you end up just doubling up and putting extra layers on top and more on top. Do you know what I mean? The point at which you can say, okay, our network, we're going to close our My Documents on the network and our shared areas on the network. It's that moving away from that reliable hardware network in your organization, where you know we own all of this data, it is in our place, and you're not actually trusting the cloud.
I think he conflates, I'm just reading more as we go, I mean, he conflates quite a lot of things here. He's conflating, for example, owning your server architecture, and I would say that it's almost never a good idea for schools to do that, fair enough, unless you've got absolutely mission-critical stuff. If you've got awesome IT people, absolutely run your own mail server, why wouldn't you? But economies of scale for storing data makes it sensible to at least have your backups in the cloud, and to have kind of production-ready stuff, which just ticks over on your day-to-day things. But he's folding in things like licensing. Now, there was a whole tirade that I was reading on Mastodon today about someone talking about the move to everything being a subscription service. So yeah, it does look like it's a lot cheaper to not buy, for example, loads of licenses, but instead have a subscription model to Adobe or whatever it is. But that is just meaning it makes it a lot more difficult to then migrate off that onto a different product, because you end up having subscription silos of products. So instead of you owning this thing and you've paid for the software and you can use that for as long as you want, and then you can move on to something else, and the interoperability between those two, you're now locked into this kind of subscription thing. And if you decide that's no longer the best thing for you, the cost of switching subscription things is pretty immense. Now, I'm not against subscription stuff. I use Spotify. There's loads of things I subscribe to. But at the same time, I kind of know I'm locked into those things. If I wanted to move from Spotify to Apple Music, oh my goodness me, what a pain in the ass that would be for my life. So there's loads of things which are conflated in this article. So I'd pick it apart with care if you're reading this.
I think so. But I think all his points are valid. But I do think they need to be more fleshed out. To be fair.
And of course, all of these things like Microsoft and Google are riding the wave of like reducing costs of IT infrastructure. It would be interesting to look at the overall lifetime costs of some of these things.
Yeah, I don't know. And our sort of OneDrive SharePoint licensing is done via our whole school Microsoft licensing and Windows computers and Microsoft Exchange and Microsoft servers and that kind of thing.
If I was Microsoft and Google, I'm pretty sure they would have done this. You just move the budgets around. So no longer, like Dai has saved now 75% of his budget, but the money just gets shifted around elsewhere.
It does indeed.
Hmm.
Cool. Okay.
Anything else to say on that? No.
Sorry?
Anything else to say on that? No.
No.
Okay.
I don't know. Other than I would never be without my cloud tools, kind of thing. But anyway.
Yeah. And I'm talking to you on a Chromebox, like which I use as the device I use in my office most of the time. But I think there's a difference between, you see, these are all the things that need teasing apart. There's a difference between using the web as the platform and open interoperable standards. So using things like WebRTC and you know, everything being based on standards and interoperable versus saying the cloud is the thing. Like the cloud needs, as a concept, needs like picking apart, because all of these things that we've just been talking about, subscription services, hosting your data, you know, providing collaboration, all of these things are conflated together as the cloud, as if it's one thing, but it's really not. And I feel like an organization, instead of moving to the cloud, should critique the cloud and decide what it wants to remain in-house. So businesses are like well ahead of what schools are talking about and do like hybrid cloud things, where some of the things they keep inside the enterprise, and then they kind of keep other things like collaboration things or whatever in what is commonly known as the cloud. So I'd go a bit beyond what Dom's talking about there.
Yeah, no, I think it gets more complicated than that. And there are lots of obviously very sensitive things that you might not want to store in the cloud and you want to keep in-house in a school, which is important.
Okay, next one. You've got teenagers are better behaved and less hedonistic nowadays.
But they're lonelier too, I think it says, and more isolated. Mm. So this is an interesting article from The Economist, which is looking at the idea, because everyone's always talking about how teenage behavior is changing. And it's usually done in a very negative way. And that's not a new thing to talk about teenagers in a negative light. But this is an interesting one because it's got some statistics to say that teenagers are actually behaving themselves better, kind of thing. So it has this little graph called Teen Angels from the World Health Organization. And it's looking at behavior and attitudes of 15-year-olds. And it's going from, I think, 1996 to 2014. So this is 15-year-olds, and how many of them have been drunk twice? What percentage of 15-year-olds have been drunk at least twice, do you think? Well, that's declined in year 2000, that's up over 50%, and now it's down just down below 30%. Similarly, have had sex. This is quite an interesting thing. So at the age of 15, if people have had sex or not, this has also declined from the year 2000 down to 2014, being about 20% in 2014, which is down nearly 20% in itself. So it was nearly 40% in England in 2000. And then the last one's an interesting graph, I think, which is it's labeled Find It Easy to Talk to Fathers. And this has gone up.
It's gone up massively,
Yeah, and it's like a big sort of 20 to 30% rise again, really. Or maybe not much. But no.
So in the year 2000, so 2001, 2002, that was down below 60%, and now it's above 80% for British or English for teenagers. Find it easy to talk to fathers. And just if you go down, it says, one possible explanation is that family life has changed. A study of 11 countries found that parents spend much more time on childcare. In America, the average parent spent 88 minutes a day primarily looking after children in 2012, up from 41 minutes in 1965. Fathers have upped their childcare hours most in proportional terms, but they still do much less than mothers. Because families are smaller, the hours are spread across fewer offspring, end of quote. Now, I saw something the other day which was talking about I think it was in The Guardian. It was talking about paternity leave as a Trojan horse for basically better parenting by fathers. And it was saying that during paternity leave, you know, you're off work to look after the baby and to get the house ready and do all that kind of stuff. And all of the work that happens during that paternity leave, even if it's just 2 weeks or however long, that lasts all the way through the child's life. And so I'd be really interested to correlate that with like paternity leave with an uptick in finding it easy to talk to fathers. Although I'm not sure that paternity leave has been rolled out across all of those countries, or they might have done.
Well, it's difficult. So what the stats are there for France as well. And in France, it starts in 2000 at just over 60% and it ends up in 2014 at just over 60%. But on the way, it takes a great dip down to the lowest in 2009 at under 40%. So it could be related to national policy in that case. And there's lots of possible explanations for this data, but still it is showing that things are changing. I'd argue as well that that life is not simply repeating itself, and that things are changing as they go on. So being parented by my parents, who had their experience and were children in what, the 50s and 60s, as in young children at these points, is very different to me, who was a child in the 80s and 90s, or 70s and 80s. And so when my children come to face the things that children face about, you know, questions of alcohol and sex and other such things, I can relate to them much more because I grew up in a much more similar environment to them than my parents did to me. And I think these things come closer because society is just is building on itself. It is layers, you know, it's not, and I think the gap is actually smaller between, although saying that I was quite a young parent, I guess. But I don't know.
It's interesting that this is in The Economist because it's framed in a very kind of economic way. There's a bit where it says, meanwhile, paid work is collapsing. In 2016, just 43% of American 16 to 19-year-olds were working in July during the summer holidays, yada, yada, yada. And it's not just paid work collapsing for teenagers, because people, the kinds of job I had when I was younger, as a student working in bookshops and record stores and that kind of thing, they, you know, those Saturday jobs are just snapped up by people who need the work to support their families, I guess. But it does mean that because there's automation, there's less outsourcing, all that kind of stuff, there's less work to go around. And interestingly, there's a book I'm reading at the moment called Utopia for Realists. I don't know if you've seen this one. And it's been referenced quite a lot, but it was very expensive in hardback. I've just bought it in paperback and I've nearly finished it. And he talks about the 15-hour work week and how, actually, if we kind of can soften the landing of automation a bit, we should be working less, because actually automation can make us more productive. We have a bigger lever on the world. So therefore, you know, if we can work a bit less, we can spend what would be classed as our leisure time building those kinds of civic society and institutions and having the kind of relationships that we actually want, rather than just working all the time. So it's an interesting framing of this in The Economist as well.
Yes. I have some interesting references. I'm just going to read a couple of paragraphs here about technology in the family. So technology also enhances surveillance. Parents track their children's phones and text frequently to ask where they are. Benjamin Pollock, a student at the University of Pennsylvania, remembers attending a camp in Israel when he was in high school. He communicated with his mother every day using Facebook Messenger and other tools. As it happens, his mother had attended the same camp when she was a teenager. She contacted her own mother twice in 8 weeks when she was there. Worries about teenagers texting and playing computer games too much, and before that, watching too much television, have largely given way to worries about smartphones and social media. And that's a fair statement. Last November, Chamath Palihapitiya, formerly a Facebook executive, said that his children were not allowed to use that shit, quote, but strong evidence that technology is rewiring teenagers' minds is so far lacking. American and British data show that, although heavy internet use is associated with unhappiness, the correlation is weak. One paper on Britain by Andrew Przybylski and Netta Weinstein suggests that heavy computer and smartphone use lower adolescents' mood much less than skipping breakfast or skimping on sleep.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's spot on. It might be that people are using lots of technology, but it's the lack of sleep that makes them problematic. So,
but I also think the idea that the idea of instant messaging. So for that, we can kind of go to text messaging, social media, I guess, it's fascinating, the idea that it's bringing families closer together because they're more constantly in touch. You're more, you know, the reminders, your parents are more in your pocket kind of thing. And your children and yours, you kind of know where they are, and lies are told less, I'd imagine, because, you know, you save the lies.
Found out. Yeah, exactly. It's an interesting thought about what effect that has on your sense of self and your personality. My hypothesis would be that you have a weaker, there's a, the writer, the philosopher, Iris Murdoch, her husband, John Bailey, was talked in his biography of, one of his biographies of Iris Murdoch, talked about how Iris Murdoch talked about how always feeling like she had a weak sense of self, and she wasn't sure whether that was a good or a bad thing, feeling like she was just part of everything else as well. And when you're interacting with other people all the time, when you're constantly connected, I feel that like weakens your sense of who you are sometimes. I certainly feel that like, when I consciously disconnect, when I go walking in the mountains, I have a much stronger sense of who I am and what I like. And I actually become slightly left, slightly less left wing, for example. Not, I don't become right wing, but I'm still left of center. But it kind of recalibrates you when you have those periods by yourself. So I wonder whether we need some kind of study about that in terms of, and maybe that's to do with, you know, the bit at the bottom, the lonely in the crowd, that I make things easily, I make friends easily at school graph. Mm. Whether that's because instead of seeing yourself as a thing, you see yourself as part of a network. And I don't know if I'm making any sense here, but it's harder for you to do that because you're seen as being outside of your usual network and usual group.
I think it's quite interesting, isn't it? So certainly I've had experiences, but this is an adult and not as a child. And it's different when you're a child and you're growing up because your brain is wired differently, I think, and you're looking for different things. But I certainly had a sense in my use of social media that the friendships that I've made feel quite robust and reliable. And some of them have turned into exceptionally good friendships like ours. And but there was a wider network of friends and people I could call upon and spend time with. But then I'm aware of times in my life when what happens is that because through my online identity, people wouldn't know when I would be going through difficulties in my own life, and I wouldn't be able to actually talk, or indeed I wouldn't want to expose that area of my life to that community of people because they're not really friends in that kind of way. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And it becomes a sort of a difficult thing. And it's possible that what you're talking about there is that identification of self is not the same in your online network as it is in a real life one. But also I think you have this issue with schools and friends. I mean, how many friends can you have at any one time? Like friends being not people whom you know and get on with, but friends being people who you can depend on in a time of need, I guess, but also at other times. And, you know, you can say, can you give me a lift here? I'm stuck or I need this.
Well, there's an element of vulnerability to that, isn't there? And I think that you can't be vulnerable to everyone all the time. There's different levels of being vulnerable, et cetera.
But I'm just thinking who's left. School set us up to have lots of friends, like we should have loads of friends when we're at school, but actually that's not really the way it works. I go back to my childhood, I had three, there were four of us, three very close friends, yeah. And we were a group, and that suited me fine. I there was lots of other people who I was friendly with, but they weren't friends as such.
Well, I had a conversation with my kids about this the other day, Grace, who's seven, and I was saying, like, you'll probably not even remember most of the people who are in your class now when you're an adult. And she was like, what? Of course I will. But of course you don't. Like, if I think back to my first school, I can probably think of four people in my class. But as you say, you get trained that people who are the same age in your year, they're the people to have friends with. And I think that's a real shame in society in general, actually, in terms of friendships across ages. And that's one of the things I really value about things like Scouts to some extent. You know, Ben's got older friends, Grace has got older and younger friends. Also like church youth groups, that kind of thing. I think it's really good for just mixing things up in terms of ages and abilities and family backgrounds, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, isn't it? But what it does show me in quite with some clarity is that we ain't there yet. You know, people don't understand things, not just with technology, but the whole shooting match. It's still developing, it's still emerging. The way that we raise children is still getting better, it's changing, and it's not all good, but I guess
it's got to be a good thing that parents are spending more time with their kids. I can't see how that could ever be conceptualized as a bad thing.
Absolutely.
And yeah, I think as we talked earlier about the move to kind of online education, I think if we can, we might want to shorten the school day at some point, because you know, we don't have to, the babysitting role is reduced for schools because more people are working from home, or, you know, one person is deciding not to work for a while. Brian Mother said something interesting to me the other day. We were talking about, you know, the work that we've got coming up, the work that we've done. And he was saying, you know, well, everything's a season, isn't it? You don't have to decide that this is it from now on. You just decide to do this for a season. And a season can be 6 months, it can be a year, it can be a couple of years, but you decide that you're going to do this for a certain period of time and then kind of move on to something else. And I guess that's the world we live in. We don't ever have to fix what we're doing. A career is just whatever you decide to make of it. It's not a ladder per se.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, going back to the distributionism I mentioned at the beginning, that's what my take on that as well, is we're just going to try something for half a term and review it and see what we think. And it doesn't have to be set in stone. We don't have to stick with it. It's you know, we're not wedded to the idea, and it's important to be agile in all things, as well as consistent. Okay, there's a double.
Yeah, it's a mindset thing, isn't it? And certainly in the interviews I've been doing, when I was hired at Mozilla, there wasn't really a role advertised particularly. They decided they wanted me, and I wasn't the only person. Obviously, lots of people at Mozilla were hired because of who they were. There was work to be done. But it's a lot easier to train people and help people learn new skills and give them new knowledge than it is to kind of change people's minds in terms of their values, their beliefs, their mindsets, their approach, their enthusiasm for stuff. So, yeah, it'd be interesting. Anyway, let's move on. What's Chris Leach bestowed upon us?
All right, this just popped up over coffee this morning. What has he bespoken? So it's called Intergalactic, and it's ICT on the end of Intergalactic. And it looks like a really cool approach to setting out a scheme of work for ICT, and it also has a lot of computer science in it. So if we go to the introduction. So it's the project's inspired by Star Wars, Star Trek, the culture novels of Ian Banks, the novel Mirror Friend, Mirror Foe by Robert Asprin and George Takei. So what he does is he sets up this sort of role-playing stuff and sets the scene. So there's a character name generator the children are made into groups and they get a transporter ship, intergalactic cosmic transporter ship, an ICT. And the first has to generate a character name. So they have to, they do this little random name generator using Python. This is, and run that, and they get their team names, and they're in their teams, and then they get their ship names as well. And then, so he's made it on Google Sites, and it just moves on. So you go into, you have droids, and you have to do your droid development, where you have to give them a name, and then he gives them, they have to be given input devices, keyboard, mouse, microphone, camera, touchscreen, barcode scanner, controller, joystick. And it's all sort of backed up, and then you have to have output devices as well, and then you have to kind of allocate where they're going to be on your droid and how many cameras they're going to have so the droid can move around and things like that. So it's just giving children, you know, introducing them to technology in all sorts of different ways. So the page that he tweeted out this morning, I think he's just written, was about storage devices, which I have to teach, looking at punch cards to Laserdisc CDs, SD cards, whatever, and then looking at storage capacities, and all that sort of thing. And the way that he's done it is, it's just really, really interesting. He's doing a really good job.
It's not finished yet. He's still writing it, I guess, as he's going along.
It's in trial at the moment, I think, with year four, possibly. No, year six he's trialing it with, I think. But I think he intends to kick it off from the beginning in September. So he's just working.
Oh, he's building it at the moment. This is the kind of thing, and when I mention like GitHub to, you know, people who are not like yourself, people like regular teachers, it's just like, oh my goodness, etc. But this is the perfect thing to go on GitHub. So you can make GitHub pages with a few clicks. And then now if I wanted to copy that, first of all, so I'm not saying this isn't great. This is great work. And Chris, you've done a fantastic job if you're listening. But first of all, how am I supposed to know if I can use this? There's no licensing information on there at all, which means by default, everything is copyright, all rights reserved. So that's the first thing. I have to get in touch with you. And I can't see an easy way of doing that to find out if I can use this. Secondly, if I wanted to fork this, if I wanted to make my own version of this, I'd have to like copy and paste it or like code it myself or whatever. On the other hand, if I was using something like GitHub Pages, then I could make something which looked almost exactly the same, very easy to do. GitHub Pages has built-in themes, etc. There's a repository, and you could put a license on there, which you just literally do a drop-down menu to say what license you want, like Creative Commons or whatever. And then I would have to press one button to fork it, and I could make my own version of it using like Markdown or something like that. And given that this is for computer science, I think that would be a much better option than using Google Sites, I have to say. But love the concept. I love the gamified concept approach. It also ties into some interesting things, I think, with this month's Hello World magazine, which I've only just flicked through because it arrived yesterday, I think.
Yes, no, mine turned up this morning. I haven't read it yet. I think all the things you're saying are valid. I think Chris is using the tools at his disposal, and he could use other tools, but it depends what he wants to achieve. He's going to use Google Docs with the children, so he's probably liking the fact that he's using Google Sites. He'll probably be able to show it to other colleagues and say, you could use Google Sites too, which he could do with GitHub, but GitHub will have other barriers to entry, as in it's not...
No, I'm not saying that, like, oh, you should use GitHub instead, but it wouldn't it be great if there wasn't this chasm between easy-to-use, what-you-see-is-what-you-get tools like Google Sites and, like, what actual developers use, like GitHub. If there was like training wheels for GitHub and we were using more of that in schools. What I did notice actually in the Hello World magazine was that it was encouraging, you know, the like meta level stuff in terms of how you organize your project in when you're coding, developing, doing that kind of thing. It was talking about the importance of using Kanban in your lessons, that kind of stuff. Okay. It was like showing you how you could use Trello with your classes to show like the backlog, what was up next, what you're doing at the moment, what's been done, what was in the code review, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. I'll have to have a look at that. That sounds like an interesting article.
Well, it's good to see that kind of stuff, because I think actually the workflow stuff is it's possibly the thing which people struggle most with in terms of communicating with non-developers within a reasonably technical organization.
Yes, I mean, we started doing GitHub accounts for our students once one of our A-level students looked at their education policies and things. And but we never, it's kind of stalled. There's something went wrong with it for some reason. But I'm pretty sure that we could open that up again. And it would actually be quite a compelling way to possibly use Python. And to learn Python is to store all your programs on your GitHub page. So you have a record of everything that you've done. Kind of. Might work quite well.
Just to say, like, GitHub is GitHub, and a lot of the world's code is on there. It's worth having a look at. There's GitHub for Education, which people haven't looked at recently, is pretty good. I'd be a fan of, you know, going back to the cloud example before, there are ways of doing this where you can host it locally instead of giving, you know, a for-profit organization kind of more attention. You can use things like GitLab, and you can do like repositories and forking and stuff locally. So you might want to have a look at that as well. But yeah, GitHub for Education, education.github.com. That's some useful stuff.
No, they've definitely upped this a lot. There's teacher training to master Git and GitHub on here. If you go through to the bit for teachers, you can do the training.
And there's, I think there's free private repositories as well for students, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's...
Well, I put a few links in here, mainly, so the week before last, I took the unusual step of not sending out a newsletter. In fact, I sent out an email to say I wasn't sending out a newsletter to people, which might constitute a newsletter, but was more of an un-newsletter. And then last week, I was quite tired and didn't get as many Thought Shrapnel posts out as usual. And all of them, interestingly, looking back, were talking about kind of rest and productivity and work-life balance, that kind of thing. So just a few here, which I thought it might just be worth flagging up. There's a wonderful, wonderful, the first one's called Tolerating Uncertainty, or that's the title I've given it in Thought Shrapnel. And it's riffing off an article in The Cut by Kristen Wong. And it's actually channeling a book, which I've read, which I didn't think loads of, but that might be because I'm already of a philosophical persuasion. But I've written on ambiguity before. A guy called Jamie Holmes wrote a book called Nonsense, The Power of Not Knowing. And it's talking about how if you can't tolerate uncertainty, if ambiguity like drives you mad, that's quite linked to anxiety and depression. So you need to get better at tolerating uncertainty, especially because of the world we kind of live in. Like reduce your need for closure in any particular situation. And I've forgotten this, but the advice he gives you, he says, two ways to get comfortable with uncertainty, perhaps surprisingly, are reading fiction and multicultural experiences, i.e. reading some books and traveling, which obviously you can do at the same time. It says travel, reading, learning a new language, experiencing another culture. These all present new experiences to your brain, which force you outside of your comfort zone in rewarding ways. Also, they are fun. Sounds like a pretty certain win-win. So I thought it was an interesting thing.
I think that's, I agree, but it's just like gap year world, isn't it? Excuse me, a little bit. And it's, you know, life is about, generally speaking, staying in one place and doing that well. And I do, I mean, I have traveled quite a lot and read a lot of books, but yeah, and I wouldn't say they're bad things ever. But I do think it when I do think tourism is losing its credibility or its value in a way. I mean, it's great to go and visit places, and I always feel a bit sort of sad at being a tourist, and the trips I get to go on in as part of school are usually, or have, you know, the one to Kenya and the one to India in particular, or the ones to India have been really valuable because of the connections that we have with people out there that we forge because we're taking children out there. We want to make sure that everything's going to be okay. They allow us to get into the local communities in ways that you just wouldn't if you're a proper tourist, as in paying for a holiday. I think it's quite interesting. And I remember, so I was talking to some of the children on the India trip, and they said, "Sir, what's the best experience that you can have going traveling? Where's the best place to go and to do?" And it was a very difficult question to answer. And I'm not an extensive traveler, I wouldn't say. I didn't backpack as a kid or anything. I said I don't think it's about that. I said I think it's a little bit about serendipity and kind of who you run into and what happens whilst you're on the road, as it were. And but also it's about the people that you're with, and these things generally come down to people. So sometimes other bits of culture can be breathtaking and awe-inspiring, seeing things for yourself and being there. But usually the best experiences of life are about those that you have with other people, these things that you share with other people. And it was a difficult one to answer anyway. So, but having said that, seeing India, seeing Kenya, seeing how other people live is properly humbling. I was aware before I went that I am one of the most privileged people in the world, from the social economic circumstances that I grew up in. And my life is one of...
Well, we talked about that picture of the Taj Mahal, and then someone, was it, did you take that picture or someone had taken that picture? Here's the Taj Mahal, isn't it beautiful in the early morning mist or whatever? And then turning around and going, look at all the people taking exactly the same photo as me, and there were just hundreds of their people there.
Exactly, I guess that's why they're called World Heritage Sites and the Wonders of the World and all that kind of thing. But, you know, that's why they're there, sort of thing. And I was just thinking, actually, looking at the pictures of you in up on the Scottish borders, that it was very similar to Dartmoor, where I'd been at Easter with our gold D of E. You know, the pictures you were taking, the terrain looks very, very similar.
Well, that's what Hannah said as well, because she grew up near Dartmoor. So she was saying, okay.
It was not just me. But I think it's interesting. So when you go out walking, for example, you have a purpose and you're going to do something. Whereas just going, anyway, I don't really know where I'm going in relation to this post. It's just, I just do have a feeling.
Well, the thing I find interesting, there's a book which I've mentioned before by Alain de Botton called The Art of Travel. And in it, he quotes Seneca. And Seneca makes the point that I think I've mentioned before, which is when you travel and you go somewhere else, you have to take yourself with you. And what he means by that is when you go and see the Taj Mahal and all these amazing things that have been described in guidebooks, you're not seeing them like as a blank slate at that point in front of this thing that you're going to see. You're taking with it all of your baggage, all of your emotional issues, all of your physical ailments, all that kind of stuff. So to expect to have this transcendental experience just because you're looking at something beautiful is misguided. The whole point is, you know, it's the whole kind of, it's the journey, not the destination. So I'm sure it'd be similar for you. The best things I've ever had and the experiences that really stick in my memory, the transformational things, are the things that I didn't seek out, the serendipitous things you mentioned, and the things which I was expecting to be boring or whatever. I can still remember, for example, walking along in Canada with Hannah, who was still my girlfriend at the time, and walking along just in a regular street on the way to get somewhere much more interesting. And it started absolutely pissing down with rain. And two or three people as you walk down the street opened their doors saying, "Would you like to come in out of the rain?" And I just thought, oh my goodness, this tells you everything you need to know about Canadian culture. That would never happen in the UK.
Yeah, and there are other things. I remember going, was it Easter? Sometime recently. It was Easter. I was in Rome. And it was a half time. I can't remember whatever the hell it was. I went to Rome and I just remember going to this big sort of religious place. I can't remember what it's called. It had some kind of name. It was very famous. And there was just all tourists all over the place. And it was this, there's the one with the hole in the ceiling. What's that called? It's a great thing. Anyway, so there was rain coming in as we were there, which was quite amazing because the rain comes in the hole. But obviously by the time it hits the floor, it's all of the rain has moved a couple of meters in one direction. Because of the currents of air in the room. And anyway, when I was in Bucharest, but it was very stale because everybody in there is just a tourist admiring all of this Roman Empire nonsense, right? And which is kind of fine. But then when I was in Bucharest in Romania, we were visiting churches, these really old, old churches, which are so ornately decorated. And I'm not a particularly religious person. But it was fascinating to sit there and watch as the local people came in and prayed. There wasn't a service going on, and that's not something you see in England at all. It's very culturally different, but it was a bit voyeuristic in a way, but I was just very happy to sit there watching the different people praying in the different ways, approaching different saints, icons of saints within the room and in the building, and I found that to be fascinating. But if there'd been lots of tourists there, it would have been really not
that's part of the issue is everyone thinks that they're a traveler and not a tourist. You know what I mean? Everyone.
It's why I have a great respect, really, for, when you see the sort of stereotypical American couple, maybe in their white socks and trainers and their beige shorts, taking photos and being unafraid to talk to everybody. But I quite respect that in a way because they're not actually trying to pretend that they're a traveler as such. They're doing tourist things. They're on holiday. They're being a tourist and they're doing tourist things.
I tell you the really weird thing that happens to me. It happened last month in Berlin and it happened in the Netherlands. It happens literally everywhere I go. I must just walk with confidence and I always get asked for directions. And I'm like, I don't yes. even speak the language of the country I'm in.
Absolutely. That's the thing. Because I don't know if it's anything to do with my childhood because I moved around a lot. So I didn't, every couple of years we'd move. So I was always making new friends in different places. And so I'm not worried about talking to people in, 99 times out of 100. I will just say hello and get on with it if I need to find out some information or whatever. It's an interesting thing. I don't know. It's bizarre, but I would never argue that multicultural experience is not important for everybody. Multicultural awareness is important as well. Just people.
I think just also traveling, for example, just the worst thing is now you can get Wi-Fi on airplanes. It used to be great when you just had the period where you couldn't connect to anyone and it was like free license for however many hours to read a book or to do some thinking and stare out the window at the clouds or
I mean, that's the thing. As far as I can work out, especially these flights with televisions on, you just bang your headphones on and start watching movies or go to sleep and eat. And that's all you do. You don't really interact with the other people around you much. And I guess that's what's going on with phones as well. And as you say, Wi-Fi being available on these services now is making that happen all the more.
I find it very difficult. We want Ben and I went to watch Black Panther on Sunday, which was fantastic. But it's the first film I've seen. I must have seen like two films this year, maybe three. And I don't watch films just because I need something to do with my hands. Like, I can't. I need to be making some. I need to like be the thing that I'm watching. I need to influence in some way. I haven't said that. It was a great film, but it's interesting that and people talk about people's attention spans going down. I think it might be that, but I think it's also the fact that, I don't know, just you want to get on and do stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I enjoy films and putting my body to rest, if you know what I mean, and just sort of thing. But I think Black Panther's really interesting. I went to see it at the cinema as well when it first came out, and I'm not going to talk about it here, but I'd love to spend a couple of 3 hours unpacking that.
It was really interesting angle, you know, as a historian. I wanted to talk to him about slavery, colonialism, all that kind of stuff, and it just kind of naturally flowed from the conversation on the way back. Hilariously, we almost didn't get into the cinema because I completely forgot that the cinema, being right next to St. James's Park in Newcastle, where Newcastle play, going there at 5:10 on a Saturday, or Sunday, sorry, might not have been the best idea.
Oh, did you go this Sunday? Just after the last match of the season?
Yeah, and Newcastle beat Chelsea 3-0, last match of the season. So there was a lot of, you know, fat Geordies with their tops off celebrating. And we're driving the car through, right round the stadium. And my son's eyes were progressively opening wider and wider as he was seeing more and more fat, drunk Geordie celebrating. Yeah.
Well,
we managed to park just in time and get in. But there were 40 minutes of adverts. Oh, my days.
Were they really? Oh, my gosh. Well, but you talk about multicultural experiences. They give Ben, you're immersed in Ben in one there, almost.
Another couple, just quickly, they're talking, we've kind of touched on this in terms of rest. Inevitably being, you know, I was in the Washington Post, it was talks about America and, you know, workaholism, is that the right word, in America? But I think it's also, I always see the UK as being like a halfway house between Europe and America, and not always for the best reasons. But it talks about the balance between work and rest, and I kind of talk about this book, which I've just mentioned before, Utopia for Realists, and so I say what we actually need for a flourishing, healthy society and democracy is more rest. There's a guy called Alex Pang who wrote a book called Rest, which I mentioned on a previous podcast, and he talks about how leisure is framed as a way to get more work done, whereas actually we should value rest for its own sake, as kind of leisure, as time to be you, as opposed to just be productive in terms of being economically useful.
Yeah, I know, and that sort of extends to being economically useful to your own household as well. One of the things that always struck me about owning a 5-bed house in London was how much time I'd need to spend looking after it. And I'd just be like, okay, this isn't quite so much fun. And because I'd had so little rest time, having 3 children and a teaching job, it's quite interesting. And I do think when you trace back the idea of money and income and housing, it's a really difficult thing because people are coming from poverty and like the development of the middle classes, industrialization and the other developments that have been since, you do get this sense of factory of and all of these things, and getting away from that sort of self-sustaining life where you'd have to actually exercise your body quite a lot every day, eat really healthily because you were eating the food that you grew, and things like that. And I think there's going to be a pushback towards more of that kind of life as we get older.
Well, it's interesting because another post I just put on Thought Travel last week was about Jeff Bezos, how do you say that? The person, the CEO of Amazon. And no matter what you think about Amazon, I use them all the time. I don't think that they're particularly a force for good, but I've kind of come to terms with their business model, given that I get Amazon Prime deliveries the next day. But he talks about, there's an interview which is summarized in this blog post, and it talks about work-life balance. He sees it as a circle. He says, I think it's worth everybody paying attention to it. You never want to be that guy, and we all have a coworker who's that person, who as soon as they come into a meeting, they drain all the energy out of the room. You can just feel the energy go whoosh. You don't want to be that guy. You want to come into the office and give everyone a kick in their step. And I think that most people, awesome people I know, including yourself, Di, have nothing like a work-life balance. You know, they work hard, play hard, but they're connected to something which they want to make a difference in the world, like a mission, and they're trying to achieve that mission. And it's not like, oh, well, now I am going to cut off my working time and now is my playing time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I was talking to a colleague about this. So I'm finishing my fourth year at a boarding school, and it's my first time I've ever worked in or been in a boarding school. And they do expect us to work kind of crazy time. And I do champion the fact that after 20 years of teaching, I've worked out how to reserve time for myself in every day, not to let myself burn out and to look after myself in that regard so that I stay happy in my work, because it wasn't instantly obvious to me when I began teaching that I had no business putting my mood into my classroom. So I always, I decided at a certain point in my career to be cheerful in the classroom, and still maintain that to this day. And so I enjoy myself, and hopefully the children enjoy themselves in nearly all of my lessons. So and so I sacrificed that. What I felt though is when I was at work as a teacher in a day school, the weekend my head would mostly be full of work. It would, you know, work would always be spinning around in my head, and that wouldn't be unwelcome. I would allow it to do that. I would want it in a way, particularly because the work I do is really interesting because I work with technology, and technology has been developing so much in the last 20 years. But now I kind of get paid for that, and I get much better longer holidays because I work sort of 6 to 7 days a week, every week. So I get my first day off this Sunday since Easter holidays, and that actually quite like that. But in another way, it's hard. In another way, it's quite nice. But one thing I did like about this post is the idea of the work-life circle, so that one should flick you into the other, should flick you back into the other kind of thing. When you sent it out and thought shrapnel and sent it to a friend of mine who had been discussing that work life balance thing, and said you should see it
in this book that I've been mentioning, The Utopia for Realists. He talks about all of the countries that have the highest television watching statistics, like Japan, the USA, etc., the ones that work the longest. And then the flip side is the ones who have the lowest working hours per se have the strongest kind of civic society, the most church attendance, the most kind of involvement in clubs and associations, that kind of stuff. And I thought it was really interesting in terms of using up all of that attention and that energy and whatever, and how we should, you know, get people really interested in the work they do, etc. But that can spill over into everything else. Instead of thinking about work as a compartmentalized thing, thinking about the difference that you want to make in the world and how all of these things that you do are just instantiations of a wider thing, that dent that you want to make on the universe, to channel Steve Jobs. So I definitely agree with that. And I think that when I work really hard, I go and have a whiskey in the evening, and I'll often go and watch something on Netflix. But and if I've worked much more hours than usual, if I work my normal hours, I don't drink alcohol during the week, and I try and just read instead of going on screens more. So it's much more sustainable to actually do the right amount of work rather than trying to just do more stuff just for the sake of getting more stuff done, in inverted commas.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. I agree completely. And on this note, we should stop working.
We probably should. It's just almost 10 o'clock on Tuesday night. What are you up to for the coming week, Di?
I don't know.
You must start half-term soon, surely.
I know we have half term. I'm going to Spain for half term, and it's not next week, it's the week after. So there are children exams tomorrow. So I've got my fifth form coming in for some revision classes tomorrow. They stood down for study leave yesterday, but they're coming back to see me just for a last hour or so refresher before their second exam on Thursday. So it's full exam temperatures here, you know, which is in the boarding house is quite interesting, is how to look after the young men who are sitting these exams, and you know, it's different forms of pressure for different ones of them, and there's a sort of working culture that isn't normally quite so intense the rest of the year, and things like that, and just it's a sort of challenge how to look after them and know where to draw the lines, or help them draw the lines. So that'll be dominating my coming week or so. How about yourself?
It's the Thinking Digital Conference at the Sage in Gateshead on Thursday, which I'm very much looking forward to. I always enjoy that conference. In fact, to the extent that when they announced the early bird ticket soon after last one, I bought it without knowing who was going to be speaking or whatever. It's just always fantastic. So It's a one-day conference on Thursday, but then tomorrow, the day before the conference in the afternoon, I'm going to a session. There's all these different workshops, 3 hours of workshops. Last year, I went to Christine Payne Documentaries, on kind of using your mobile phone for journalism, that kind of thing. This time, I'm going to one called What Your Senses Say About You. And I've had to already submit what type of phone I've got. And I think what we're going to do is show how people can make inferences about what's happening and the data that you get from different parts of your phone. I think it's an academic from Newcastle University. So looking forward to that.
That does sound fascinating.
So taking a bit of, I'm using my non-Moodle day on Thursday and taking a half day annual leave to do some of that. And then I've never actually stayed in Airbnb before, but this is going to be my first experience when I go down to London on Sunday the 20th. I'll be there until Friday the 25th for this MoodleNet design sprint. Martin Dougiamis, the Moodle's founder and CEO will be there. Outlandish of running it. Should be really good. Get lots of stuff out of it. I've got some cool preparation to do. Met people like Andy Field, Miles Berry, Mary Cooch, Christian from London CLC are coming along to help with the testing on Thursday. And then As soon as I get back on Friday the 25th, the next morning, I'm off to something called Mara Camp, which is a scout camp for the whole of the northeast of England, really. Massive. There's going to be like shooting and quad biking and all kinds of stuff going on. So I'm helping out with that for the bank holiday weekend. And then I'm taking a couple of days off because I'll get burned out otherwise. And that's half term. So my wife and children will be down in Devon at the in-laws while I recover and then do a couple of days work at the end of that week. So okay. I'm thinking we might fit in, if you're free in Spain on the 29th, we might fit in a episode then, but otherwise we might have to punt it to June.
Okay, sounds good. I forgot to mention, actually, I've turned my Amazon Alexa Echo thing off because I found that I didn't use it. My listening device, I forgot to mention this. I did it about a month ago. So someone told me that you could get a sensor for your Hue lights, and the thing that I used my Amazon Echo for most was to turn the lights on and off. But now I've got a motion sensor, so they just turn on when I come in the room. So it's kind of cool. And then the only other thing I listened to was a radio. And so my Echo is connected via Bluetooth to a receiver that goes into my hi-fi. And it kept stuttering, which was very annoying when you're listening to the radio or music. So I just decided I'd just connect the Bluetooth thing straight to my phone, and I didn't need Alexa anymore. So she's no longer part of my life. She's just sitting there gathering dust on the other side of the room.
Oh, wow. Well, while we're talking about trackers and things... like infringing on your privacy. I still am using Google now a little bit, Google Assistant, just for things, just because I've been testing out, you know, voice stuff. I'll probably take it off at some point. The other thing I use it most for, my wife and I do the crossword in the I newspaper almost every day, or the Guardian at the weekend. Uh-huh. And, you know, it gets the last two or three and you just get completely stuck, and it's then the lunch break, back to work. And I just say like, okay, Google, crossword clue, whatever it is, and it comes up and we just finished off. That's the thing I use it most for, and also the weather in the morning. But one of the great things about being on Mastodon, there's lots of people on there who are concerned about security and privacy and all this kind of stuff. And someone had shared a link to something called Blockada, which is Blokada. Now, you can't get this on the Play Store. It's blockada.org. You can't get this on the Play Store, only via F-Droid or via their website, because it doesn't conform to Google's conditions. And that's because it blocks at a system level. It's got like a blacklist and a whitelist, and it blocks every kind of advertising request. So I put this on my device on Saturday, and I've had 2,316 blocked requests to advertising tracking sites.
Wow. Well, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? To everything we ever talk about to do with pervasive technology and or invasive technology.
The other thing you can do, which you might be interested from a lots of different points of view in terms of, you know, kids in your school, everything like that. You've probably seen that Cloudflare have now got DNS servers at 1.1.1.1 and 1.0.0.1. That's kind of a fast privacy aware DNS server thing. There's also AdGuard and Komodo Secure DNS, Free DNS, Google Public DNS. You can choose your DNS provider as well, like OpenDNS, etc. So you can reroute your traffic via a DNS provider that you'd prefer rather than your ISP.
Okay. Very sounds cool. Good.
Anyway, we should wrap up. Good to talk to you as ever. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Tide number 102. And we'll catch you again in a couple of weeks' time.
Take care, everyone. Bye-bye, Doug. Watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a darker bay.